So, for those of you who haven't met me before, if you haven't yet figured out my accent, I'm originally from South Africa. I'm a seminar leader, a teacher, and a writer, and I live in the Dominican Republic right now in the Caribbean. And for the last 10 years, I've been leading seminars and writing about personal development. And my passion over the last couple of years has moved into relationships, and particularly when I met the love of my life, Chelsea. He's actually listening on this call at the moment. And when Chelsea and I went through the power struggle stage of our relationship, we had a really tough time. And through learning what I learned in that power struggle stage, that year of figuring out how to make our relationship work, I ended up bumping into so many other couples who were going through the exact same thing and who were breaking up or struggling to navigate conflict in their relationships. And they started asking me for support. So, well, we saw you and Chelsea get through your power struggle. How did you guys do it? Can you help me? And before I knew it, I was a relationship coach without even really meaning to be. And so that's kind of what got me here talking about relationships. And it's a passion of mine, helping couples create deeply connected love affairs, because it's one of the last areas of growth, I believe, that we look at. You know, we go to school and we learn how to, we learn how to do the basics like speak English, and we learn about science and history and language and mathematics, but nobody ever teaches us about relationships. And relationships are probably the most important thing we need to learn about if we're going to be successful and get by in life. So there's definitely a need for it. And if you look at the divorce statistics, I mean, it's even more apparent that we're screwing up our relationships. The last time I looked, and you know, the statistics vary from country to country and depending on which surveys you look at, but all of them are above 50% divorce rate for first marriages, and they're going up to 75% for subsequent marriages divorce rate. And if you think about it, if you're single right now, that means that every single relationship you've ever had has failed. I mean, if you count the success of a relationship by its longevity, which I don't necessarily, but if you did, it would mean that every relationship you ever had has failed. Now, I'm not saying that to make you feel bad. I just want to point out how uneducated and how hopeless we are at navigating relationships. On the other hand, if you are in a relationship right now, and let's say you've had 10 relationships throughout your lifetime, that means that the only relationship that survived is your current one. And the jury's out as to whether or not that one's going to continue. We hope it will. So that gives you a success rate of 1 in 10, which is 10%. So really, our relationship success rate sucks. It stinks as human beings. And I believe a big part of it is because we're uneducated and we don't have the support and the knowledge for how to navigate through relationships. And so hopefully today we're going to put a little bit of a dent in that and start to make a bit of a change. So let's start off with some questions. I'm just going to read through the questions and then jam through some of the answers, and then we'll open up the lines for some live questions. The first question comes in from, I don't know the name because they didn't come in with names, but I'll read it out to you. It says, Bruce, how do you not lose yourself in a relationship? How do we maintain our rights, etc., that we give to our partner and at the same time not settle? How do we stand up for ourselves without fear of being rejected? Thanks. I love your videos and your blog. Hoping the next relationship is the one after four massive failures. Okay, so the question is, how do you not lose yourself in relationships, basically? Well, I want to play a little thought experiment with you as a way to answer this question. I want you to imagine that you were God and you'd created this, you know, this crazy species called human being. And imagine you were playing God for a minute and you had this problem. You had to ensure the continuation of the human species. So in order to ensure the continuation of human species, you need to make sure that humans reproduced, right? And that they not only reproduced, but that their offspring survived. So in order to ensure that the offspring survived, you realize, I also have to ensure that the parents stay together long enough in order to protect and raise the child into a full-grown man or woman. But then you're faced with an unexpected challenge. And in trying to figure out a solution as to how to continue the human race, and you're designing human beings, you insert a trait that you both love and hate at the same time. And this trait is different from all other traits that any other animal that you ever created ever has. It's the trait called free will. And you love this trait because it makes human beings so special because they have free will. And at the same time, you hate it and annoys you because you can't control them. And because human beings have this pesky trait called free will, and they don't do what you expect them to do, especially when it comes to staying together in relationships, this becomes a threat to the survival of the species. Because if human beings don't stay together, they don't mate, they don't have children, and or the children die. So you have to, you figure, scratching your head, that you have to make them want to stay together. And the easiest way, you think, to make them stay together is to have to make them dependent on each other. You figure, if you make human beings dependent on each other, then they'll stay together, they'll mate, they'll raise their children, and the species will continue. So you think about this for a while, and you figure the best solution is to take away free will for a while so you can control them just long enough to make them dependent on each other. So you drug them, right? You build in the special module into their brains that releases a cocktail of drugs when they meet a compatible mate, okay? And these drugs, called vasopressin and phenylthylamine and dopamine, these drugs make the human being think that it's in love, but just long enough for them to mate and have a baby, okay? And in this state of, this drugged state of being in love, this romance, everybody and everything is roses stage, the human being loses its free will temporarily and operates under a couple delusions, okay? The first one is that the other person's perfect, their partner's perfect. That's a complete delusion that happens when you're in love. The second delusion that these drugs induce is that the other person is the source of them feeling amazing. They don't realize the drugs are making them feel amazing. They think that the other person makes them feel amazing. Because every time they're around their mate, they feel amazing, right? The third delusion is that the other person... the third delusion is that they can't live without the other person. And the fourth delusion is that mating regularly with the other human is a very good idea, right? So the humans fall under the influence of these drugs when they meet their compatible mates. They lose free will. They fall under the influence of all these delusions, and then they mate and they have a baby. And so now God thinks, okay, so now I've figured out the task of figuring out how to have them reproduce. Now we need to figure out the second task, which is how do we make human beings stay together long enough in order to raise their children? So we think, well, you know, let's just be productive here. Seeing rather than reinvent the wheel, I may as well just drug them all over again. It worked last time. So we take the path of least resistance, and we insert a second module in the human's brain. And this module is designed to release the same cocktail of drugs, but instead of this time when they see their mate, it releases the cocktail of drugs when they look into their child's eyes. If you're a parent, I'm not, but if you are, you know what this experience is like, because I've heard it all my friends and parents say. They look into their child's eyes, and they just feel this unconditional love, right? That's the brain releasing the cocktails designed to make you stay with your child long enough and not abandon it in the streets so that the child gets raised and turns to a full-blown adult. And when this happens, the brain releases those same chemicals in the bloodstream, and the human thinks it's in love with its offspring. And that way, they'll protect it at any cost, right? And that is why you lose yourself in relationships, right? Because nature drugs you, and you begin giving up your life in order to be with another person, mate with them, and raise children together. So there's a couple of kind of, this is a fun little story, and the drugging part is definitely true. I mean, science shows your brain does release these chemicals when you're in love, and you release this cocktail of chemicals, and the feeling of being in love is really physiologically and biologically a group of chemicals. So I want to make a couple of points here out of this story that I made up. Point number one is, losing yourself is nature's way of ensuring that you continue the species and you mate, right? So you're designed to lose yourself. It's not a problem. It's not a if you fall in love and you lose yourself, that is not something to be fixed. It's probably the most common complaint I hear from people. How do I stop losing myself in my relationship? How do I get myself back is probably a better question. So firstly, if you've lost yourself in your relationship, it's because nature's drugged you and designed you to do this so you continue to the human race. Secondly, you're normal, and there's nothing faulty with you. You don't need a therapist. You're human. You can stop trying to fix yourself. And thirdly, I've got this question for you. Would you really want to not lose yourself for a while when you fall in love? Isn't that the reason why love feels so beautiful? I mean, isn't that why we love falling in love, is because we lose ourselves and then we complain about it afterwards, right? Because we stop identifying with ourself, capital S self, with our ego, and we start identifying with God and the oneness of everything. It's that same bliss experience as when we have an orgasm. It's, you know, we forget about ourselves and we just fall in love with everything in life. And I don't know about you, but I would rather lose myself and have the experience of love than figure out how to not lose myself and never fall in love. So I think the question of how do I stop losing myself is actually kind of a mute point. I think we all enjoy losing ourselves, and it's not necessarily an unhealthy thing. I think that the greater question is, how do I get myself back, right? And I've actually developed seven core, or kind of discovered seven core skills you need to learn in order to get yourself back. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about later on, and that's exactly what I cover in the Love at First Fight coaching program. If you want to follow on with the actual list of skills, you just go to loveatfirstfight.com, and as you get to that webpage, if you scroll down a bit, you'll see seven skills. You might need to stop the video playing because the video automatically plays when you hit that webpage, but you can follow along with them, and I'll share them with you again at the end of the call. Okay, so that's my answer to the first thing. You're drugged, you lose yourself, and the question is not so much how do you stop losing yourself, but how do you get yourself back? And we're going to answer that later on in the call, but I just wanted to explain that so you weren't left thinking that losing yourself is something that's wrong with you. Okay, next question. Bruce, why do I always fight with my partner, and why are we always at each other's throats? Okay, this is a kind of a culmination of us. I've got this question asked about 15 times, so I just summarized it. So here's why we fight. Okay, when the drugs wear off, as they inevitably do, we wake up, and I call this wake up, I love hangover, right? We wake up with a hangover, with a throbbing head, basically, and we realize just how much of our life we've sacrificed, compromised, and given up being with our partner, right? And suddenly we're faced with this other real-life human being who unfortunately has needs too, and unfortunately isn't perfect, and they've got their own flaws, and they've got needs that they want to have met. And maybe the two of you have already had a baby, and you end up in this life, and it certainly isn't perfect anymore. And the drugs have worn off, and you have needs, and you're not perfect, and the baby screams all the time, and you're like, oh my God, this is my worst nightmare. And you wake up inside the love hangover. Now, your love hangover might not look like that. It might be a lot more peaceful love hangover. We all react to it in a different way. But essentially what happens is anywhere between 2 hours and 2 years after falling in love with your partner, according to the research, the chemicals of vasopressin, phenylphthalamine, oxytocin, and a couple of other chemicals that get released in the bloodstream when you're in love, they start to wear off. And when they do, you wake up to the reality of how much of your life you've given up and how much of your own power you've given up and had to compromise in order to be with your partner. And at this stage, you realize, oh my God, I need to get my power back, and I need to get back at any cost, and I'm willing to fight for it if necessary. And you enter the second developmental stage that relationships go through that's known as the power struggle stage. Because in this stage, both couples, or both partners in the couple, are fighting to get their power back. The first stage they call the romance stage or the romantic stage. The second stage they call the power struggle stage. I say they, this is developmental theorists. And in this stage, the two of you are fighting to get some of your love and your life back, right? To reclaim some of the independence that you both gave up when you fell in love with your partner. And the two of you became codependent. And it's almost like you had to become codependent in order to love each other enough to stay together to mate and to raise a child from an evolutionary perspective, right? And if you don't succeed at reclaiming your independence and autonomy through fighting or struggling with power, you may decide that the only way to get your power back is to leave the relationship. And this is where almost all divorces happen, which is in the power struggle stage. And in my experience, most people never make it through the power struggle stage. They just get used to it. Because we haven't been taught the skills and how to conflict resolution, how to actually navigate through the power struggle, we just get used to it. And they end up living out a life in a relationship that's less than optimal, where they don't have the communication skills, where they're not getting their needs met, and they're both suffering, and they get used to the suffering, and then life sucks, becomes kind of like a normal way of being inside their relationship. So what often happens is, as you pull back and as your partner pulls back to try and reclaim some of your independence, some of your needs that your partner was previously meeting stop being met. And so now you've got to fight to get your needs met at the same time as kind of reclaiming your independence. So it's this push-pull struggle begins. And if you don't succeed at getting your needs met, you may decide the only way to get the love and attention that you were getting from your partner is to have an affair. So very often what happens is, like, during the power struggle stage, as one partner pulls back in order to try and meet their needs themselves and to reclaim their autonomy, the other partner is left feeling like they've been abandoned or rejected, and they don't get their needs met anymore. The partners don't know how to communicate about getting their needs met. So what ends up happening is the partner that feels rejected often goes off and has an affair. And the fighting begins. And the fighting is really just an attempt to get your needs met. I really want you to walk away from just one thing with this call. Take on this distinction that your arguing with your partner is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not a dysfunctional thing. It's you attempting to get your needs met in some way, shape, or form, and attempting to reclaim your autonomy and still feel loved, still feel like you can count on your partner, still feel like you have somebody there for you, and like you're an independent person. So it's kind of juxtaposition of two seemingly opposing needs that need to be fulfilled. So you have this push-pull dance that happens, and that's why it's called the power struggle, because it's a struggle for power, right? So that's question two. All right. So let's have a look at question three. Bruce, why do some people react so strongly to the silence treatment? After all, it's nonviolent and perfectly legal. I'll read that again because it's funny. Why do some people react so strongly to the silent treatment? After all, it's nonviolent and perfectly legal. Okay, so in order to make sense of what you said, I want to just share a little kind of personality typing system very briefly with you that I call the hailstorm and the turtle. What tends to happen when couples hit the power struggle stage and they begin to fight for power is they experience disconnection from their partner. And when we human beings experience being disconnected, we usually react with what's called a protest behavior. You've seen protest behavior in children. If a child isn't getting attention from its mom, it'll start crying. That's a protest behavior. If a child still doesn't get attention after crying, the child will throw a tantrum and break something. That's protest behavior. And as adults, believe it or not, we actually still do the same thing. When we experience disconnection from our romantic partners, we still protest, but instead of doing the childlike crying, I mean, we might cry, we might still throw tantrums, we generally have a more subtle way of doing it, but it falls under two broad categories. There's two broad categories that we do this, that this looks like. And one category I like to call a hailstorm. And a hailstorm is the kind of person whose energy explodes out when they're feeling disconnected from their partner and they're feeling that pain of the disconnection. So maybe what happens is, you know, you feel rejected by your partner, and if you're the type that is a hailstorm type, you feel this pain of rejection, and you want to plug back in. You want to plug back into that feeling of love again. And so what you do is you start to reach out towards your partner, desperately trying to connect with them again, and your energy explodes out. Now, of course, the other kind of partner is the opposite type. We call this the turtle. And the turtle type, generally what they do is they withdraw. Their energy implodes when they feel disconnected. And they kind of crawl back into their shell for fear of being hurt by the hailstorm's explosion of emotion. And you've got this dynamic dance, this kind of cat and mouse game that ensues, where one partner's desperately seeking reassurance and the other one's desperately seeking space and independence and autonomy. And the other partner chases, you know, the hailstorm chases the turtle, and the turtle keeps escaping, running back to the shell. And both of these protest behaviors don't get the result, the desired result, which is to feel more loved. Neither people feel loved when this ends up happening. And this dysfunctional strategy for trying to find love, I call it dysfunctional because it doesn't work. This ineffective strategy for trying to find love is so common you wouldn't believe. I did a conference call about a month and a half back, and 3/4 of the call recognized, you know, related to being either a hailstorm or a turtle. So the question was, why do some people react so strongly to the silent treatment? Well, that's because they're hailstorms, and their biggest fear is being rejected. And when you do your turtle thing, I'm assuming the person writing this question is a turtle because they give the silent treatment, and you said, after all, it is long, nonviolent and perfectly legal, so now you're trying to justify the silent treatment. So if you're a turtle, it would feel obvious to you that that's the only way to deal with conflict. You shut down, but you protect yourself. That's what you learned, and that's the strategy you learned when you were a child. But for a hailstorm, that's the scariest thing in the world. And so that's why they react strongly, is because it feels like a rejection, and it feels like you're running away, and that love is being taken away from them, and they feel like they're being abandoned. On the other hand, you might want to ask yourself, you know, if you are a hailstorm, why your partner shuts down, this might help you understand, is that they're scared. They're scared of that energy that you're exploding at them. And they've learned, the strategy they learned as a child when dealing with feeling disconnected from their parents was to shut down, because when you shut down, you don't feel the pain. You kind of pull yourself up into your head, zip yourself up, as my girlfriend Chelsea describes it. For her, she's a turtle and I'm the hailstorm in the relationship. You zip yourself up and lock yourself away, and that way you're protected and you don't have to feel any pain. So that's question three. I hope that answers that one for you. I'm just going to quickly unmute everybody and say hi and see if you're all there. for those of you on the call, could you just all say hi and just say hello and let me know that you're still alive and well. Just say hi.
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 Yay! Okay, we got people here. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't talking to myself. I'm just going to put you back in lecture mode. Actually, let me just ask one quick. Is this making sense to everybody? Are you following? Do you want to, anybody want to ask a quick question at this point, like a 30-second answer type question? Okay, I asked you three questions. That was a dumb thing. Say yes if this is all making sense so far.
Yes.
Okay, beautiful. I love it. Thank you. For those of you who have a question, anybody have a quick question, just you can ask a question at this point if you'd like.
Bruce, it's interesting because I think in our particular relationship, we can drop into one being a turtle one day and the other one being, like, I can sometimes be a turtle and sometimes be a house. My partner is always turtle.
Got it. So you can sometimes be a turtle, sometimes a hailstorm. Your partner is always a turtle. That's quite a common pattern. We have both within us. I'm going to go back into lecture mode and mute everybody now as we continue. But I'll just quickly answer that. We all have both capacities within us. And I know I was in my marriage before I got divorced. When I was in my relationship with Adele. We were both hailstorms, so we would flip-flop depending to the other side of the spectrum, depending on who was playing what, so that we could have this dynamic. But often what you find happening is that once you've reached the end of your tether, very often we'll flip-flop into the other ones, and very often the hailstorm, if they do not get any response from their turtle in their shell, they just sulk, and they go into the shell and disappear. They go, well, screw you, and disappear. All right, so let's have a look at the next question. Okay, question number four. My ex-wife is a hard-headed, jealous woman in such a way that we've separated presently, but I still love her and I can't live without her. What can I do? Oh, boy. Sounds like you're in trouble. You still love her and you can't live without her and you can't live with her. So what I'm hearing in this question, I mean, not knowing any more than this, is that you're still under the influence of those relationship drugs we're talking about, that you still feel that you're so in love with her because you're under the influence of drugs. It's the love drugs, and you probably have a shared connection. You've got a history, and I totally appreciate that. So what I would recommend is, you know, take a break and don't do anything right now. Time heals, because over time, the drugs begin to wear off. And once you found your senses again where you're not compulsed to be with her, and you can actually make a choice with free will, weighing up the pros and cons, you can work with a relationship coach with her and see if the two of you can resolve your issues and get back together. But trying to do it now while you're so triggered on your own will never work. I just recommend you go get a relationship coach and actually get some guidance. I don't know enough about your situation to really give you good advice about that one. So I'm going to move on to the next question. At what point do you leave a relationship and when do you make it work? Okay, this came in from about three or four people. And so I don't think there's a stock answer here, but I'll share with you my criteria, because this is it's a really good question. And, you know, how do you know when to leave? I think there's very few times when it's healthy to leave if you're into personal growth. I think you leave when it's an abusive relationship, when it's physically abusive. My criteria for leaving is if being together doesn't create more love in both of your partner's life, then I might consider leaving. But only, and it's a big but, after trying everything at my disposal to figure out how to make it work, right? So I'll say it again. If being together doesn't bring more love to my life and to my partner's life, then I might consider leaving if after I've tried everything at my disposal and I still can't make it work and I'm no longer committed to making it work and it's not serving us. I'll give you an example. When I was married, I had exactly this situation. My ex-wife and I had struggled for a long time to make our intimate sexual life work, and it just was never going to work, and none of us were happy with it. We had a best friend relationship, and I got to the point where I was cheating on her at the time, and I hadn't told her about it, and I realized that me cheating on her was causing her so much pain and causing both of us so much pain, destroying both of our lives. Even though she didn't know about it, the energy that brought to our relationship was just completely destructive. And I realized I didn't have any connection to wanting to make it work. There wasn't a bone in my body that wanted to make our that part of our life work anymore. And I realized I wasn't serving her and I wasn't serving me. And the most compassionate thing for both of us to do was to go and tell the truth to her, clean up my mess, apologize, and get out of that relationship so we could both move on. And a week later, she met the love of her life, who she's still with right now. And you know, I met the love of my life a couple of years later, and I'm so glad I did, because had I still been banging away in that relationship trying to make it work, you know, forcing it to work, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, it wouldn't have. But, you know, we had spent several years looking at it, gone to therapy, tried everything, we really had, and it wasn't working. So that would be kind of my criteria. Personally, I believe that any conflict can be resolved if both parties are willing to grow together. And one of the hardest areas to grow is in giving up the belief that you're right. And this is one of the fundamental things you've got to do if you're going to make it in a relationship, because being right is hardwired into our brains as animals. Like, we want to be right. It's one of our fundamental primary drives as humans. And I would talk more about it, but it's a little bit beyond the scope of this call. But if you're up for the challenge, it's a rewarding one. I think if you work with a great relationship coach and you've got a guide and you have a guide through the power struggle stage, it's really easy. And again, that's what my Love at First Fight coaching program is all about, is helping people master those seven skills that you need to learn in order to navigate yourself through the love at first, I mean, through the power struggle stage. So if you want to check out the seven skills, again, they're at loveatfirstfight.com. Just stop the video and scroll down halfway and you'll find them. Okay, next question. Once your partner has lied to you and cheated to you, is it possible after that level of pain and betrayal to rebuild trust and have a fulfilling relationship? Absolutely. Great question, and I believe anything's possible. I mean, if I was to say no, then I'm basically saying, well, it's never possible to recover from any kind of betrayal. It totally is, if you choose to. And, you know, during the power struggle stage of my relationship, Chelsea and I did some pretty dumb stuff with each other. I mean, she broke up with me, fell in love with another man, and went off to be with him. It never worked out with him. And during that time, I said some pretty dumb stuff to her. I lied to her. She lied to me. We hurt each other a lot. Like, we were triggered. And if you've ever seen a cat that's being dragged towards a swimming pool, that's what a triggered human being looks like metaphorically, right? We are just like hair standing up on end, hissing, like total survival mode. Our reptilian brain is activated when fight or flight mechanism, and we are not in control of our minds. Our brain literally drains the blood from the brain into the limbic system so that we can fight our enemy, physically fight. Because when we were cavemen, that's what we needed to do. You know, if we were triggered in fight or flight mode, we had to fight for our life. We had to figure out, am I going to club this person to death, or am I going to run for my life? In both cases, we need to have our bodies activated and our limbic system activated. So the brain drains oxygen from the brain, the mind brain drains oxygen from the brain and takes it into the blood system. So we actually become stupid. We become dumb. We could become almost mentally paralyzed when we're in fight or flight. And that's why we say the stupid things to our partners that we do when we're triggered in a fight. And so Chelsea and I really hurt each other. And then we did the healing work. We took 6 months apart, and I just said to her, I love you, and I still want to be with you, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to make this work. And I realized I need to do a lot of healing work on myself, and the only person that I could transform was myself, and she realized the same thing. And we got a good relationship coach, and we rebuilt the trust between us. And mostly, it was a matter of seeing each issue as a misunderstanding. We had to kind of become detectives and figure out that, you know, when you said that, what was that all about? And then we started to look for the misunderstanding between us. And I could see, you know, at the end of our coaching sessions, I began to be able to see Chelsea's cold behaviors as just a turtle survival strategy. And she could see my demanding behaviors, my neediness, as just a hailstorm survival strategy. And we both stopped seeing the other person as a perpetrator and ourselves as being the victim. And we started to take responsibility for our relationship. And when we did that, we fell in love all over again. And we fell in love in a much deeper, more mature way. And this is what in developmental psychology they call the stability stage. This is post power struggle stage. Very few relationships make it to the stability stage. They usually stable out or kind of get used to the power struggle stage. So it appears like it's a stability, but it's not, because the stability stage is really characterized by realizing you can't change your partner and make the choice that, you know what, I don't want to change my partner anymore. I love them just the way they are. I love their foibles. I love them warts and all. And in the stability stage, you've learned how to manage conflict. You learned how to resolve conflict and turn it into an opportunity for intimacy. And it's hard to do that if you don't have a roadmap. And of course, we weren't taught this at school, so we're stuck. So if your partner's lied and cheated to you, it's absolutely possible. In fact, I don't even think it's that hard, because your partner probably lied to you only because they were in survival mode, and they cheated on you only because their needs weren't being met. Remember earlier I said one of the core distinctions I want you to take away from this call was that a partner's complaints are usually all about their needs not being met, or their actions are usually driven by their needs not being met. Well, that's probably what happened. If they cheated on you, they weren't getting a need met in a relationship. And once you figure out how to get that need met inside the relationship, you can work it out. Bruce, what kind of workload will be in the Love and First Sight coaching program? I'm going to answer that later on. I should have deleted that question and moved it later. Okay, next question. So what's the best way to protect your relationship from outside influences like bad advice, negative people, and a world that no longer values monogamy? Okay. So this is a loaded question. But I'm going to answer the part of it that's what's the best way to protect your relationship. Because I think for many of us in relationships, one of our fears is that we're going to lose our partner to another person. And I personally believe the best way to protect your relationship is to create safe spaces. You need to become a master at creating the kind of space that's so safe that and so intimate that your partner would never want to leave you. That's not a manipulation where you have to protect your relationship by building up walls from the outside to trap your partner in. But it's a space that's so much fun. A friend of mine that they don't want to leave. A friend of mine told me a story once, a beautiful little story. I don't know if I'm going to get it right. I'm going to try and remember it best I can. He said, imagine you're sitting on your balcony and this beautiful little bird comes and visits you. And you say, hi, little bird. And the bird says, hi. And you have a conversation with the bird and you love the bird. The bird sings for you. And then the bird flies off and does this little thing. And eventually you miss the bird. And the bird comes back a couple of days later and you say, hi, little bird. I'm so enjoying your company. Thanks for visiting me again. And the little bird jumps on your shoulder and says, oh, I enjoy you too. And I like being here on your shoulder. Can I stay here a little bit longer? And you're like, yeah, please, stay as long as you like. I love you on your shoulder. You're on my shoulder. And the little bird flies away, and you really miss the little bird. So you think, well, next time the little bird comes back, I'm going to see if I can make the little bird stay forever, because I want to hang around the little bird a lot. So you go out and buy the little bird a cage. And next time the little bird comes back, you say, hi, little bird, I brought you a present. And the little bird smiles. You say, well, yay, what is it? You say, jump onto my hand, I'll show you. So the little bird jumps onto your hand, and you put the little bird in the cage, and you lock the door and close the door, and the little bird starts crying. You say, what's wrong, little bird? And the little bird says, I don't want to be in a cage. I don't feel free. And then eventually the little bird dies. Or you open the door to the cage, and the little bird flies away and never comes back. Now, you've heard the phrase, if you love somebody, set them free. Well, this is exactly what I had to do in my relationship with Chelsea. I had to set her free. She wanted to move to New York. I was living in the Dominican Republic. And the only way I could make the relationship work was to create a safe space for her. And the safe space was a space where I accepted her no matter who she was, just for what she wanted and what she didn't want, and just for who she was and for who she wasn't. And part of what she wanted was to live in a different country, not in the same country I wanted. And eventually I had to learn to accept that that's what she wanted and set her free and let her out of my cage called, I want you to live with me in the Dominican Republic. And when I set her free, it took her 6 months, she came back. But until that point, I was wanting to, I really wanted to have her with me. It was like, I don't want to be in a long-distance relationship. So I tried to get her to stay with me. I tried to convince her that the Dominican Republic was a great place to be, and she just didn't want to be here at the time. And so she left because I, didn't support her, or she didn't feel safe in the relationship. She left on her own accord, broke up with me and left and moved to a different country. And I look back and I can see how I created that. At the time I was like, you crazy, nasty person, how could you do that to me? And I felt like a real victim. It took me a little while, but I realized, hold on, I need to take responsibility here. And how did I play a part in making this happen? I basically created a cage for her. And no wonder she flew away the minute that door was open. She bashed that door open and ran away. And I think if you're trying to protect your relationship by putting up barricades and walls, you're going to manipulate your partner and you're going to make them run away. You're going to push them further away. So one of the tricks is not to try and trap your partner, to create a space that's safe enough that they want to be with you. And that's week 3 of the Love at First Sight coaching program that starts this Saturday. We talk about all about how to create safe spaces. So the next question. All right. How do you know if your partner is still into making the relationship work? Are there signs? Yes, you ask them. You communicate. That's my answer to that question. If you don't know something about your relationship, ask your partner. Question solved. Problem solved. If you're not asking your partner, then you're not communicating your relationship. You're going to struggle. Next question. Hi, Bruce. My question. How does one resolve emotional infidelity in the relationship? The case being that where one partner discussed in-depth problems with their relation about our relationship with a longtime friend, being a member of the opposite sex as well, and also had flirtatious talks about sex. Obviously, the matter has many angles to it, and after 2 years, still not resolved. Okay, so what I'm hearing you say here is that your partner discussed the intimate details of your relationship with a best friend and then started flirting about flirting sexually with them. Okay, so I get that this might have a lot of charge for you, and this might be an issue that causes a lot of pain for you. So I want you to know that the real issue or the solution to this is to discover the real issue behind your upset. And it's your upset is not that your partner was talking to your friend, their friend, and it's not that they were flirting sexually with each other. That's not the problem. The problem is the need that wasn't being met behind, that caused those actions to happen. And if you're trying to deal with this on the surface, you will never get resolved. If you're trying to resolve the issue that your partner flirted, it'll never get resolved. If you try to resolve the issue in the fact that your partner shared intimate details with their best friend, it'll never get resolved. I want to say this to you. If your partner's running off to their best friend to share intimate details of the relationships, of their relationship, rather than accusing them of having betrayed you emotionally, ask yourself this question. How are you not creating a safe enough space in your relationship for them to come to you? How is it that they felt they had to go to their best friend and talk to their best friend about it rather than come to you? And if you start to look at yourself instead of pointing the finger at your partner, you'll find the answer probably comes a lot faster and the solution to your problem comes a lot faster. Again, this becomes about safety. Personally, on a personal note, I'd never want Chelsea to stop flirting with men. Chelsea loves flirting with men. It lights her up. It lights the men up that she flirts with. The day I ask her to stop flirting with men is the day I kill the safe space in our relationship. I know Chelsea would say the same thing about me flirting with other women. So I'd be very careful to label emotional infidelity on anything, to slap that label on anything, because that interpretation of what happened will just open up a can of worms that will lead the two of you not having happy things happen in your relationship. So it's all about creating safe spaces and learning how to find the needs behind the needs that aren't being met in your relationship and learn how to resolve those needs not being met. And that's, again, something we deal with in the Loaded First Fight coaching program. Okay, next question. Bruce, how do you encourage your partner to be more expressive for better understanding? Again, show them that it's safe. Hold their hand. Lead the way for them. If your partner's not feeling safe to express themselves, they've probably been trained like that either by you or by their parents and the way they were brought up. And now your job is to train them differently. And I'm going to recommend you use reflective communication. If you haven't learned how to mirror somebody and how to say back to them what they said to you in a way that has them feel heard and understood and validated, then you're really missing out on probably the most revolutionary conflict resolution tool that's ever been created. It's sometimes known as the Imago Dialogue. We're going to teach you in depth how to do that in week two of the Love at First Sight coaching program. I gave you a free video, if you watch some of my free videos, about how to do this, where I taught you the basics of mirroring just the first little bit. But essentially what it is you want to have your partner experience being heard and gotten by you. And you do that by saying back to them what they've said to you, just making sure that they get that you've understood them. And there's a way to do this without sounding like a robot and without sounding mechanical, and it's incredibly powerful and healing. And when you do that, generally you don't even have to talk about the problem because the problem just disappears. Your partner just wants to feel heard, and when they feel heard, the connection automatically comes back, and the two of you feel instantly connected again. So it's a big part of our coaching program. Okay, next question. Okay, so here's a scenario for you, Bruce. I will share hurt feelings in a compassionate way with my partner, only to have my partner react immediately with strong feelings of blame and blame, hang on, immediately with strong feelings and blame them on what I said. Oh, I'm seeing, okay. So you share with your partner your hurt feelings. They react because they feel like, okay, here we go. You say, then the focus goes to where my feelings left. My feelings made them feel upset. Okay, so your partner reacts when you share your feelings, And then you have to talk about their reaction rather than your feelings. Okay, I get it. And at the end of the question, it was a long question, which is why I'm trying to summarize for you. It says, please can you speak about how to handle the situation such that the conversation is kept on track so that partner A, the one who's sharing first, doesn't get emotionally steamrolled by partner B. Okay, what you need to do is you need to use reflective communication. You need to use a structured, pre-agreed-on communication methodology that you can fall back on when you're emotionally triggered and activated. Because when you end up in a fight with your partner and the two of you are emotionally triggered, not much good can ever come of it, right? You're having your reptilian brains activated. The oxygen is drained out of your brain and moves into your limbic system, so you effectively become paralyzed mentally, and you say the dumbest things, and the two of you are just going to react to each other. If you try to have a normal conversation, you'll each time one of you says something, you will escalate the conversation to the next level. And when you do that, you hurt each other, and nothing good comes from that. So you need to have a methodology that the both of you agree beforehand you're going to use when you get into a fight, and that you practice when you're not fighting, when you're actually in a sane space, a loving space, you practice this methodology. Chelsea and I have practiced this methodology over and over. So when we do get triggered, and let's say I'm feeling rejected or she's feeling, you know, trapped or controlled, and we go into our hailstorm turtle, we immediately jump into this reflective conversation methodology that we've gotten down. And if I forget about it, like I've got a worksheet next to me like that I've printed out with exactly what to do and say, and one of us will remind the other. And that way, we don't ever get into a screaming match, or we don't ever get into a situation where we don't resolve arguments. And all our arguments end up getting resolved. It may take a while, it may take a couple of conversations, but they never turn to screaming matches. They never turn to shutting down matches where the two of us are punishing each other and doing our protest behaviors with each other, hailstorming and turtling. That very rarely happens. Whereas during the power struggle stage of a relationship, that was a constant state. I mean, it was quite often that was happening. So the trick is to have a preordained, agreed-on methodology. And again, we'll teach this in the second week of the Love at First Fight coaching program, exactly how to do this in depth. Okay, next step. Bruce, how do I stop fighting? Okay, well, I guess this is the last question I'm going to answer, and then I'll open up to Q&A from you live on the call. How do you stop fighting? Well, that's a conversation that's, you know, it's going to take me 7 weeks to teach in this Love at First Fight coaching program, but I'm going to teach you the 7 skills very briefly. I'll tell you what they are. If you haven't gone to loveatfirstfight.com already, pause the video and go and read them. You can go there now and actually read along with me. The first skill is you need to find yourself at the source. I call it be the source. And being at the source is all about being able to take responsibility for your role in how you've created your relationship being the way that it is. As long as you're blaming somebody, you've got no hope, absolutely no hope. As long as you think it's your partner's fault, you have no hope of ever getting through the power struggle stage effectively and making your relationship work. I really mean that. It's like blame is the single biggest reason for breakup, and you've got to cut it out. So what we're going to do is we're going to spend the first week, I'm going to give you a whole bunch of tools that will help you and empower you to find yourself at the source of your results, being the cause in your relationship, and stop blaming your partner and start taking responsibility. It's a really powerful week, because what it does, it overlaps into all areas of your life, particularly business. It has a big payoff with. Okay, week two, and the second skill you need to master in the second skill, in the 7 skills, sorry, I'm talking too fast, I'm going to slow down, is responsive communication. And this is what we were just talking about. This is how to have a conversation where you respond to your partner. According to research, one of the biggest reasons marriages break up is because one or both partners are unresponsive to the other's bids for connection. So one partner says, honey, why don't we go for a walk together? And what that really means in code is, honey, do you love me? And because the other person wasn't trained in how to respond responsively to this bid, doesn't understand that that's a bid called do you love me, they just go, I'm watching TV. And after enough of those, the other partner leaves. Or throws a tantrum and protest behavior begins. So we're going to learn about responsive communication, second skill you need to master. Third skill is you need to learn how to create safe spaces. That's week 3. Fourth skill is you need to learn how to complete recurring conflict. That's week 4. And what recurring conflict is, it's the kind of conflict where you have the same arguments over and over again in different form. Maybe throughout the same relationship, you and your partner always fight about the same things, or maybe you notice that in all your relationships that you've had over the last 20 years of your life, all your arguments have had a similar theme. Maybe they've all been about, you know, sexual infidelity, or maybe they've all been about feeling abused, or maybe they've all been about feeling abandoned, or maybe they've all been about not feeling loved enough. Well, there you know you've got a recurring conflict, and it's something inside yourself that keeps being triggered. And so there's a formula for resolving recurring conflict. This is formula is what actually saved Chelsea and my relationship when we went through the power struggle. We took some of our power struggles, our recurring conflicts, and we identified them, we named them. We named ours the knife dance. Our biggest recurring conflict was called the knife dance. And we called it the knife dance because Chelsea felt like it was a knife in her back and I felt like it was a knife in my heart. And we discovered this. We called it the knife dance. And once we got our knife dance resolved, that conflict, which is our main one, stopped coming up. And then we didn't really have much conflict anymore. And because we had the skills for how to resolve all recurring conflicts, now when we discover a recurring conflict, we know how to resolve it right there and then. Okay, so next one is to learn week five, and this is the fifth skill, is to appreciate and manage your differences. This is understanding your partner's personality type. And this is really important because you and your partner have very different personality types. And we all as human beings make the mistake of thinking that our partner should be like us and act like us and behave like us. And you're probably grinning to yourself because you probably recognize some of this. No matter how developed you are as a human being, it's hard not to think like that. So we're going to do in week five of the Love at First Sight coaching program an in-depth personality profile on your partner and an in-depth personality profile on you. And I'm going to show you how to do that, guide you through it, and give you a system for doing that and teach you that. Week six, the sixth core skill, this is all about developing a culture of closeness in your relationship. If you know, you could think of your relationship like a country, in that each country has a culture. So if you've ever been to a war-torn country, you'll notice the culture is generally very cold in those kind of countries. And if you've ever been to, you know, a country that's financially and economically thriving, you notice they generally have more ambitious cultures. If you've ever been to Italy, you'll notice they have a passionate, warm culture. So your relationship also has a culture, just like a country does. And your culture can be cold, it can be welcoming, or it can be warm. And I find the culture that most people are looking for is a culture of closeness. If you ask somebody how they know they're in love, they'll usually respond by saying, I just feel close. Me, my partner and I, we just feel close. We're close together. So I'm going to show you how to create a culture of closeness. It's a skill, and it's learnable. And it's doable no matter what the culture of your relationship is now. You can turn it around. I've done it. Chelsea and I have done it. And I know many other couples who I've worked with that have done it. And finally, the last skill is what I'm going to call growing together. This is the skill of learning to become an interdependent system. There are three stages of dependence that we go through. When we fall in love, we become codependent on each other. Then when we're in the power struggle, we try to become independent of each other. But that's not the end of the game, and neither is the third stage, but it's definitely the next progression, which is interdependence. And we're going to look at how the two of you can become interdependent. How do you acknowledge that you are part of a system that is interdependent, that you do affect each other and still keep your independence, yet acknowledge that you are dependent on each other? And when you master interdependence, and you can begin to play in this realm of your relationship, a whole new game emerges. If you think of your relationship like a game the two of you are playing, a whole new game emerges beyond survival, beyond just being together because you like each other, you make yourself feel good, and you move into the bliss and co-creation stage, which is the fifth stage of development in the relationship stages. Just to run through them again, it was romance stage, power struggle, stability, commitment, and bliss or co-creation. Okay, so that is the seven skills that you need to master in order to make it through the power struggle stage and not just remain stuck there or break up. And that's what we cover in the Love at First Sight coaching program that's starting this Saturday. I'm going to open it up to Q&A in a moment. Before I do, I'd just like to take maybe just 2 minutes and tell you about the Love at First Sight coaching program. Here's what it is. It starts this Saturday. It's a seven-week program. And it basically, each week, I'm going to be making you a series of online video trainings that you're going to watch in a membership site. If you're in a country where there's low bandwidth, like South Africa, you can download the audio, which will be very easy for you to stream online. And you go in on a Saturday morning, and you go and watch the video or listen to the audio, do your exercises that you're going to print out from a PDF document. And then throughout the week, you'll be working on a particular theme that we just covered, those seven themes. And on Thursday of that week, we're going to have a conference call just like this one. And you're going to be able to dial into this conference call and ask me questions. And I will coach you live about your actual relationship on the call. So that's basically the structure of how it works. The promise of the program is that by the end of the program, you're going to be able to navigate through the power struggle stage, get through any kind of conflict and return to love again with your partner and heal your childhood wounds. That's what I'm basically training you to do, is heal those things that trip you up and have your partner fall in love again and build a foundation on which you can create a relationship that lasts a lifetime. I'm really excited about this program. It's the first time I'm doing it. I've put so much love and work into it, and it's going to totally rock. And I've made it incredibly cheap for you. This is probably the cheapest program I've ever led because I just wanted to get as many people on this as possible. I've limited it to 20 people. We've sold out 13 spaces already, so we have 7 left and 3 days to go, and I'm about to send 28,000 emails out to my mailing list tomorrow doing the promo for it again. So we'll probably fill them up in the next 24 hours. So if you know you're stuck in the power struggle stage of your relationship and you want to join me, just go to loveatfirstfight.com. The program's 100% full money back guarantee. And if I have about 3 places left for some of the – I gave a bonus that your partner could come for free if you're one of the first 10 people that registered. 10 people have registered, and some of them don't have partners. So I have 3 spaces left, the next three guest spaces left for your partners. So the next 3 people to register will be able to take those slots and bring their partner along for free. So if you're into that, go to loveatfirstfight.com right now. Click the button. There's a payment option too. You can do 2 payments of $167 instead of 1 payment of $297 if you like. And I'd love to see you. We start on Saturday. And everything questions that you have about the program will be answered on that page. So I'm going to open the call up to you guys now. And I'm going to invite you to ask me some questions either about your relationship or about the program itself. We have 5 minutes left, so if you could ask a relatively simple question, I'll try and get through 2 or 3 if we can. So open the lines up. Here we go. Who would like to ask a question?
This is Alicia. I have a question.
Hi, Alicia. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm great. Where are you? Just so
I'm in New York.
You're in New York. Okay. Yeah. Great, Alicia. What's your question?
Okay. Well, okay, this is the best way I can say it. My partner often gets really defensive and reactive when I share feelings and perspectives. I want us to both stay in an open, curious, loving place when we're sharing, but he says the only way he can do that, that the only way he can stay open to what I'm saying is, without getting defensive and reactive or triggered, is to shut down and not care. So I'm wondering how, and he's shared that this is very hard for him. So I'm wondering if you can speak to how you can stay in the open, loving, responsive place without having to go to either the shutdown, not care place or the defensive, reactive place.
That's a beautiful and very, very clearly put question. Thank you. I just actually read it about 5 minutes before the call started. Your email came in with that question, so I remember it. So your partner's a turtle, okay? Were you on the part of the call in the beginning where I spoke about hailstorms and turtles?
Yes.
Okay, so they're a turtle. That's the emotional protest strategy that they've learned to deal with it. It's not going to serve them or the relationship to continue to do that. And what needs to happen is you need to create a safe enough space in order for them to come out of their shell and experience that it's okay, they're not going to die. On a survival perspective, your partner is escaping their shell because that's how they've learned to cope with pain. And so he thinks that if he comes out of his shell and starts sharing his feelings with you, he's going to feel so much pain and be overwhelmed, he's not going to be able to cope. You need to be able to create a safe enough space that holds him in a way that he experiences bit by bit. It won't happen the first time necessarily, or maybe it will, but he'll still want to go back into his shell. It's going to take maybe a couple of months of him repeatedly realizing that it's safe before he constantly comes out of his shell. I have had the same kind of partner. Chelsea had exact same pattern, Alicia. So I know exactly what this is like. And what I realized was my hailstorming was scaring her away. And the reflective communication skill that I teach is the easiest way. I mean, there's many methods, but it's the easiest method to have them feel gotten. And it's really just a matter of sharing back with your partner what they're feeling. So you might say, you know, once they share a very basic feeling, you might say to them, okay, so what I'm hearing you feel is that, hear you say is that you're feeling scared right now of sharing your feelings. Tell me a little bit more of what that's like for you. And for you to take on a stance of being curious. If there's one buzzword I want to put into your head, it's curiosity. Just think to yourself, I need to be curious. I need to be curious. I need to be curious. Rather than going into your, I need to be, oh my God, he's abandoning me. I need to get him to talk to me and open up emotionally. Just start to be curious and pull back. If you pull back, then your partner feels safe to come forward. As long as you're leaning forward the whole time, trying to get them to come out of their shell, they will lean back. So the way to have them lean forward and come out of their shell is for you to lean back energetically. Does that make sense?
I think so. Yeah, this behavior is happening when I'm sharing my feelings. So he says it's not possible for him to be open to me without either being defensive or shut down. So I understand
okay.
that as me being the hailstorm or
oh, I see. So when you share your feelings, he shuts down because he feels pain.
He says the only way he can stay open to me is to either, I guess, is to either not care, to be in that not care, I don't care, sorry that's happening to you, you know, sorry about that, or to he gets really reactive, and he says he gets reactive to me because he cares about me.
That
so,
makes total sense. I get that.
That
he cares about
said.
You, he's hurting. It's probably because he's hurting and he shuts down. He might not be able to put it into those words that, oh my God, I'm in pain, because it's such a quick reaction. It doesn't even, turtles tend to not be very connected to their feelings. They tend to live in their heads a lot more. But if that's the case, again, learning reflective communication is going to transform your relationship because the two of you agree on beforehand not to shut down, and it's part of the agreement.
Mm.
And this way he doesn't necessarily have to open up and share his feelings, but he can be there for you and hold space for you in a way that he's got a structure to follow. And turtles love reflective conversation because it's a structure, and they're heady people. They love structures. So they can just follow a system, and then they don't have to get in touch with their feelings too much, but they can still be there and open for you. I promise you, if you follow the system, it actually really, really works. And if you're thinking of being in the program, I will teach it to you in the second week, and I have no doubt you'll come back to me in week 3 saying, oh my God, everything's transformed.
Thank you.
I'm already now at time, and I promise I'd answer one more question. So I'm going to just call it that, Alicia, but thank you. Great question.
Thank you.
Okay, one more question. Who would like to ask another question? All right, great. Well, thank you, everybody, for being on this call. It seems like we don't have any more questions. This has been fun, and I hope it's been informative for you. I just want to hear a shout-out. If this has been useful for you, just say, yeah!
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 Okay, great.
Oh, yeah.
I wish you all a phenomenal rest of your day. I hope to see you in the Love at First Sight coaching program starting on Saturday. Whether I do or not, I hope you all the success, have all the success in the relationship that you have right now that you're dreaming of. And thank you. This has been fun. I'm actually really glad I did this call. It's been a whole lot of fun for me and forced me to think about how things work in a whole new way. So sending you all love. Have a wonderful day. And we'll talk again another time. Bye,
sending
guys.
You love too, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.